Hello, and welcome to what promises to be a lively discussion. This event is hosted by Yes Kiri Muir, and our audience is taken from across Scotland. My name is Ruth Watson. I'm your facilitator this evening. Ian White is taking care of the technical side of things and making sure as many people get their views aired as is possible. Our guest this evening, the man making sense of the stats and facts, is Dr. Craig Dyell, the Head of Policy and Research with Commonweal Scotland. It's with great pleasure I hand you over to Dr. Craig Dyell to take us through democracy, the haunt and Holyrood elections.
A topic that is starting to bring up emotions, bring up a lot of interested parties, literally. We are talking politics here, and it is becoming something that is taking over social media to a certain degree, especially. And it will continue to heat up as we get closer to the election. So first disclaimer, Commonweal as a lobbying think tank is party neutral. As an organisation, we do not endorse political parties. It's the other way around. We try to get political parties to endorse our policies. And we do have a reach throughout Scottish politics now. We've had policies adopted by the SNP. We've had them adopted by the Greens. We have worked with Labour on policies such as especially working with some of their campaigns around rent controls recently. We have had interest from the Lib Dems. We have even worked with some Conservative politicians, especially at a local level, around issues around local democracy. So we will work with any political party who wants to adopt Commonweal principles and Commonweal policies. That said, I personally am a member of the Scottish Greens. I joined in October 2014 in that surge after the independence referendum. I think a lot of folk joined political parties in those days and weeks. And I've maintained my party membership since then. Not quite as active in my local branch as I should be. If anyone's watching, I'll be back. Really busy with Commonweal. Next disclaimer is that I understand completely that party members will find this topic quite difficult to discuss. It is very difficult for someone who is in a political party to encourage people to vote for a party other than their own. In fact, many parties, most political parties, actively prohibit it. They have clauses in their membership saying that if you campaign for another party, you can be ejected from the party. So it is difficult to talk about as a party member. I understand that. Nonetheless, I'm going to be as objective and analytical as I can. Any views you see expressed here are mine. I'm not here representing Commonweal. I'm not here representing the Scottish Greens. I'm representing me. Unless I state otherwise and I put on another hat for just a moment. If you want to flavour this talk with that in mind, that's great. If you want to accept or dismiss anything I say tonight with those disclaimers in mind, that's fine. So, here we go. I'm going to go through very, very briefly the UK electoral system, because it's good to get a broader context. Where did we come from? I'm going to then talk about the rise of devolution and why Scotland ended up with a system of voting that isn't the same as the UK. Why didn't we just have another first-past-the-post general election style system for Scotland? Now, it's going to be interesting. It's not quite the reason that some of you might think. From there, I'm going to explain the Scottish voting system, because it is quite technical. It does take a bit of an explanation. It's one of the downsides of a more nuanced political system is it takes a bit more to explain how to use it and what it means. And then I'm going to get onto the topic that I'm sure a lot of you are here to listen to hear about, is what does this mean for the independence campaign and the implications of the voting system coming up to the next election. So the UK general election uses what's known as first past the post. The UK is split up into constituencies. In that system, you don't actually vote for a political party. This is one of the things that's not always completely understood by everyone who's voting there. You are not voting for a political party when you go to the general election. You are voting for a collection of individuals who may or may not be party members. And it's crucial to remember this point, especially when we get onto the Scottish system. Whichever candidate wins the most votes in your constituency wins the seat. They do not need to get an overall plurality of the vote. They don't need to get more than 50%. You don't have runoffs. If you get one more vote than any other person, you win, and you get 100% of the power in that constituency. Now, political parties do exist. They tend to vote together. That's the point of them. And the party with the most victorious members tends to form the government. The benefits of this system is it's really easy to vote in. One cross, one box, one vote. It's really easy to count who has the most votes. MPs have an incentive to represent their constituency on issues. Now, that doesn't always happen. I know I do remember having an MP who responded officially to a query I made of them, saying that, in their opinion, you voted for them at the general election. They got into power, and then they didn't have to listen to you at all for the next 5 years until the next election. And if you didn't like what they did during that term, that is when you had had time for an opinion and you could vote for them or someone else. But you had no right to send letters to them demanding that they do or do not do something. Next election came, we voted them out. Another benefit, if you want to put it that way, of this kind of voting system is it does tend to produce majority governments. So the parties love this system. If you're a big enough party that can form a majority using this system, you want to keep it. This is why the 2011 alternative vote election was campaigned against by just about all the larger parties who had a vested interest in it not happening. The downsides of this, candidates can win a majority support without getting massive majorities of the vote in their constituency. The record so far for the lowest vote share that resulted in an MP winning a seat was 24.5% of the vote. That was in Belfast South in 2015. So less than a quarter of voters voted for someone and they got the seat. Which is crazy when you think about it that way. And another downside is majority governments have 100% of the power when they win an election. Look at the difference in the government after the 2019 election compared to the one before. Before, they had to fight tooth and nail to get anything done, quite often didn't get anything done. Now, Boris Johnson can do whatever he likes and the opposition cannot stop him. All he has to do is keep his wits under control. In 2019, the Conservatives won 43.6% of the vote across the UK, yet they have 100% of the power. Another downside of this system is it doesn't represent regional issues adequately. It is designed for a one-nation electoral system. So you have, in Scotland, a massive swing towards a regional party, and that party is effectively locked out of power. Even if the SNP won not just every seat in Scotland, every single vote in Scotland, they would still have virtually no power in the House of Commons, unless they managed to form a coalition with the party of government, which is looking unlikely for the near future. So in 1997, Scotland voted overwhelmingly for a Scottish Parliament, and for that Scottish Parliament to have usable tax powers. Immediately after that referendum, work started to build that Parliament. A lot of that work had been done previously. You know, work had been done in the run-up to the 79 devolution referendum. Further work had been done in 1989 with the Constitutional Convention. So a lot of that groundwork had been laid. It was decided that Scotland should have a much more proportional voting system than the UK. And there have been a lot of myths and legends about why it chose to do that. The principal one being that the system was set up to lock out the SNP. And that one has been repeated by senior figures in Labour, by senior figures in the Lib Dems who were at the centre of those discussions. I've spoken to folk who were in the Constitutional Convention at the time, and the word I've got from them is that these grandees have more or less bought their own legend in the years since. That actually the discussions there were less about locking out the SNP, because the SNP was a marginal force back then. In 1997, the SNP won six seats in the general election. They were not a huge force in Scottish politics at that time. Rising, yes. Important, yes, but not overwhelming. Really, it was the fear of a permanent Labour majority in Scotland that really pushed for a proportional vote. And it was even Labour who had that fear, because they saw that attitude coming out in the 79 referendum, that people who were against it were often telling them, well, if it's just going to be another layer of Labour government in Scotland, why bother? So even Labour was looking for something different at that time. Now, the desire for a proportional system was almost universal, but the disagreements arose over which system to use, because you can design proportional voting systems around various different ways. One proposed system was just to have a single first-past-the-post vote, similar to the general election, but then to look at the overall percentage of the votes and top up the parliament based on that percentage. It was rejected because fundamentally, in your first-past-the-post, you are voting for an individual, not for a party. So having that possible dilemma over what if your party of choice didn't match your candidate of choice, that was proving tricky for some. And then a purely proportional system, say similar to the EU elections or parliamentary systems in countries like Israel, was ultimately rejected because there was still this feeling that having an MSP linked to your constituency is important. Having someone who was directly your representative, who you could speak to, was important. So we got a system that was somewhat of a compromise. You get two votes. You get a constituency vote run under very similar grounds to the general election. It's first past the post. It has all the upsides and downsides of that system. And then you get a second vote that is a second vote where you vote not for a candidate but for a party. Again, we've got that distinction between candidate and party vote. The votes in that regional vote are distributed proportionally depending on the votes cast. There is a slight complication that it isn't just a complete pan-Scotland region, as it was in the EU elections, but we are split up into several different regions. And that actually works against the proportionality of the system to a degree. I'll come back to that. Regional MSPs are ranked by the party on a list. The parties ultimately choose who gets on that list and in which order. Some parties have different ways of allowing their members to have a role in deciding who gets on that list and in what order. The Greens, for example, have a completely open democratic process among their members to decide who goes on the list. Other parties simply appoint people. Certain parties have additional rules for people who are already elected or are already office bearers to make sure that, say, the party leader does get a top spot just to make sure that they get voted back in. It's not a bad thing, really, if you think about it, because you can imagine a scenario where, for example, the party of government gets a landslide, but because of a massive smear campaign and dirty tricks campaign in one particular constituency, the party leader gets voted out, and that could cause some power imbalances. So there are advantages to having a party leader given a specific place on the list. There's a difference between the constituency, how things are handled when constituency MSPs and regional MSPs leave their seat. If a constituency MSP resigns or dies, then a by-election is held and a new candidate is selected, because again you are voting for an individual, not for a party. For the regions though, you are voting for the parties. So what happens if a regional MSP leaves their seat is the next person on that list takes the seat. So the number of seats allocated to the party in the parliament remains the same. If the list runs out, because people can't take up the seat or because there aren't enough people in the list, then what happens is the seat simply remains vacant. And that has happened in recent years when Margo MacDonald died, because she was elected as a regional independent MSP. She was effectively on a list of one, so there was no one to replace her, and that seat remained vacant until the next election. And that gets to the nub of this additional member system. The purpose of the regional vote is to make sure the Parliament has a is proportionally balanced to the votes cast in the regional vote. If 40% of the regional votes end up cast for a particular party, then the logic is 40% of the Parliament should be made up of that of MSPs from that party. It's also important to note here that there is still a lingering feeling that regional MSPs are somehow a second class of politician. They're not. They have no standing above or below constituency MSPs. They have the full rights and responsibilities of constituency MSPs. There's no difference between them. So the advantages of this system is much more proportional than first past the post, because it has that balancing effect of the regional list. It's also much easier for smaller parties to get represented. A party only needs about 5 or 7% of the vote across a single region in order to win a seat as an MSP, whereas if you wanted to win a seat in a constituency under the first-past-the-post system, even in the best case, or the worst case, you need at least a quarter of the votes, 25%. You probably need more than that. It's easier for parties with fairly diffuse support to get elected. You can compare in a general election, the number of votes gained by the SNP to the number of votes gained by the Lib Dems. The SNP end up with far more seats because they're in the last couple of elections, proportional to the number of votes they won, because their votes are much more concentrated. The same goes for the Greens across the UK, who have one MP, despite getting a substantial number of votes, and UKIP, who also managed to come second or third in several elections in recent years, yet never managed to actually elect a single MP. Now, politics of the party aside, you can say it's a fair affront to democracy that people are voting for a party and not getting represented for it. The downsides of this system is it's not completely proportional. I'll come on to some of the reasons for that in the next slide. It is harder to vote. You'd still get people confusing which, how many votes do you get on each ballot, or what does each ballot mean? It can be difficult as a voter if you have an issue and you want to approach an MSP. Who do you approach? Your constituency MSP or one of your regional MSPs? You're technically represented by up to 8 MSPs. I mean, who do you ask for help? That can give you choice if you can approach an MSP who's maybe more inclined to your politics, but it can also be a bit confusing about how you get your view across. So I mentioned the disproportionalities of this system. The fundamental thing is that there are more constituency seats than there are regional seats. In other countries that use systems similar to this, the two sections are balanced or roughly balanced. And in fact, some systems like the German federal elections, the regional seat has a number of floating seats on it, so that if the rounding comes out that you need an extra MSP to make sure that the proportionality is correct, then you can add another seat to the Parliament. We don't have that in the Scottish system. The result of that is that if you do well in the constituency section of the vote, you actually can end up overrepresented in the Parliament. Another problem is that splitting up of the country into the various regions, which increases the granularity of the vote. You have to get about 1/7 of the vote in order to get one MSP in your region. Whereas if we just had one region across the entirety of Scotland, you could get MSPs voted in on a much lower vote share, which might make it even easier for smaller parties to get represented. You can also see flaws in this system where it was obviously designed for a voting pattern where most people, despite voting for individuals in the constituency seat, most people will vote for a person from Party A in their constituency seat and Party A in their regional seat. They don't tend to split their vote. When you do start splitting your vote, you can lead into some interesting results. And I'm sure this is where some people start to raise their eyebrows and start to get quite interested. What can we do with that? Mentioned that disproportionality system. If, and I'll give you an example of this, if the 2016 Parliament had been truly proportional, then if we just look at the regional vote share across Scotland and applied that to the Parliament, got 129 seats in the Parliament. If the system had been truly proportional, the SNP would have actually ended up with 9 seats fewer than what they actually won. They only got 42% of the vote. They should have ended up with 42% of the seats by that logic. They ended up with rather more than that. The Tories ended up overrepresented by about 1 seat. The Labour ended up underrepresented by 2 seats. Greens by about 3 seats, and Lib Dems underrepresented by about 3 or 4 seats. So you can see if we had had a truly proportional parliament, 2016 would have been a lot different. You know, if you think about the maths of that parliament, where's the stable coalition? That could have been quite a different last 4 or 5 years. It might have been that other parties could have come in on this. Other parties were standing at the time. Most countries that have these very proportional systems do apply a threshold saying that you have to win at least 5% of the vote to get any seats at all. Scotland doesn't actually have that system, but in practice, I think the lowest vote share that has resulted in an MSP so far has been about 5.3%. Nobody's won an MSP seat on less than 5% of the vote. So taking this example in the 2016 voting patterns, we wouldn't have seen any additional parties added to the that parliament. So let's start thinking about some of the implications for independence. We've been talking a lot about Plan B or Plans B, about what do we do? How do we get independence if this Plan A of keeping on asking for a Section 30 order that never comes fails? You know, Boris Johnson said again today that he has ruled out any hope of a Section 30 order, ruled out any hope of acknowledging independence. So there has been talk about maybe we use the 2021 election to build a new mandate if we get a thumping majority of pro-independence MSPs there. Maybe that'll convince Boris. Or maybe we just outright, as some have suggested, use Holyrood election as a plebiscite and say, have an alliance of pro-independence parties say in their manifesto, if there is a majority of MSPs voted in this election, then we will take that as a mandate for, not for an independence referendum, but as a mandate for independence, and we'll proceed to negotiations. This has been a feature in the SNP manifesto as late as 1997. They said if they won a majority in the House of Commons, they would proceed straight to independence. And they obviously didn't get that majority at that point. And there has been a suggestion that people can split their constituency and regional vote to maximise this majority, effectively exploiting a loophole in the additional member system. And several parties have been formed with that goal specifically in mind. Now, I'm not going to go too much into the maths of exactly how many votes you need to get in each region to do this, because quite frankly, I did look at it, but quite frankly, you end up hypothecating infinity. You can make up any numbers to get the result that you want. It's the results that you actually get that matter. I'm going to talk about some of the challenges and implications of this strategy. The first one being, starting a party is hard. We're only months away from the election. Starting a party, building up the infrastructure, building up the candidates, building up the voter base is difficult. If you look at the track record of parties that have broken through into the system, it can take years. It took the SNP 31 years to break 5% of the vote in Scotland. It took UKIP 25 years to win its goal of achieving Brexit. And the Greens, you know, have been a feature of the Scottish Parliament for 20 years, and with my green hat on, you know, growing, they are still a smaller party, and they're doing that in the face of, you know, the mounting climate emergency. In 2016, we had a new alliance of parties in the form of RISE. My now colleague Jonathan Chaffee helped found that, and they tried to do exactly what's being done here, to provide that list only alternative voice in the parliament. And you know, even by Jonathan's admission, they failed. They underestimated the scale of the challenge of starting a new party from scratch. And even though they had the benefit of having an established party within their wings in the form of the socialists. This isn't to say it's impossible. This isn't to say that it's a direct discouragement. If this is something that you or anyone wants to do, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm actually in favour of the democratic process and the freedom people have to form political parties. But you should be aware of the challenges in doing this. It is not easy. If you do want a list-only pro-independence party, then I need to stick that hat back on again. Why not the Greens? They are an obvious choice in many ways. They are the easy option in many ways. They're already a pro-independence party. In fact, a recent polling of political members suggests possibly, in terms of percentage of members who are pro-India, the Greens might even have more pro-India members than the SNP do, because there are plenty of SNP members who are members of the party, but not necessarily in favour of independence. Not much in it. I'm being a bit cheeky, I know. But to say that the Greens are not pro-independence is not that credible these days. It is an established part of the party. The party is part of the political infrastructure of Scotland. They do have people in place. They do have structures in place. They have come through the swell of that political surge in 2014 quite well. They have a track record of delivering effective politics. And with mounting crises like the climate emergency coming, they have something to say on what will be the biggest challenge of the next generation. But I'll take the hat off again, because I can already see people saying, well, I don't like green politics. And that's honestly a perfectly good reason to not vote green. If you, for example, and I'm being a transparent straw man because I don't want to disparage anyone's politics here. If you are a climate change denier who thinks that burning coal is literally the only way to generate electricity, then you're not going to find the Greens as a party who is favourable to your kind of politics. So you would be looking for another party to represent your views. If you are coming to this debate saying, well, we don't need a party that is baggaged with other policies. We just need an independence-only party. We just need a party that's a complete blank slate apart from that pro-Indy push. You have to ask, though, when those MSPs get into Parliament, what are they going to do with themselves? I mean, you can take for granted that when the independence referendum bill comes in, they'll vote for it. But what about all the other bills? One option could be that they take the SNP whip, officially or unofficially, and just follow SNP party line for everything. But that leads us into an interesting problem. That kind of party would actually be illegal in Scotland. You can't set up what's known as a dummy list party that would fight the region only and try to game the system that way. The Labour Party actually tried this once in a previous election. They tried to use the Cooperative Party as their way of boosting their seats in Parliament. So Labour MSPs would stand in the constituencies and Co-op MSPs would stand on the list. And the Electoral Commission stepped in and said that this wasn't allowed, primarily because in order to be a Co-op Party member, you had to be a Labour member. The opposite's not true. Now, if this party doesn't take another party whip, then what do they do in Parliament? If they decide to fight on issues other than independence, if they choose to have policies on anything else, then you're not really a special interest tactical vote party anymore. You're a political party. You're a political party with a manifesto. I mean, I just said that if you don't want to vote green, that's fine. But if I look at this party's manifesto and I don't like it, then why should I vote for them? No matter the tactics involved, no matter the pro-independence push, if I don't like what they're going to do other than that, then I have a disincentive to vote for them. Again, this is not an argument against starting such a party. There are plenty of niches in Scottish politics. And it's not an argument against you voting for a party that serves your interests. Again, we need to have those niches filled, because voters who don't get to vote for parties that represent them, you know, end up turning to other ways to express their politics. And plenty of countries have seen things go rather bad when enough people get disenfranchised that way. Another barrier we have to think about here is the bias in the voting system. Again, most of those votes come from the constituency system, and you need, say, 30% of the vote to win a seat there. And I know that this is why a lot of these new parties are targeting the regional list, because you only need about 5%, maybe 7% of a vote in a single region in order to win a seat there. It becomes easier. However, if you manage to do that, if you manage to get 5-7% in several regions, that gets you up to 5, 6, 7, 8 MSPs. You've now got to double that vote to get your next MSP. There's a big jump up there. It gets a lot harder to cross that next barrier. This is why this is something that the Greens have found. Getting that first MSP in a region is possible. Getting that second one is a lot harder. And again, we have the bias in the system because of the granularity. If we were a completely perfectly proportional system with 129 MSPs, you'd only need 0.8% of the vote to get one MSP. But we don't have that. So you need a lot more voters. And as much as people have been talking on Twitter about this idea of storming the system with new parties, just remember that Twitter's not a big bubble. Maybe 20% of Scotland uses Twitter. Maybe 20%. Scottish political Twitter is a tiny bubble. If you're a user of Twitter, if you think you're one of the thought leaders on Scottish political Twitter, actually look at the level of people who have engaged with your most viral tweet and compare that to the majority of your local constituency. Be wary of getting excited about self-selecting online polls. What I'd suggest to people, if you're really serious about doing this, if you're really serious about campaigning for new issues, for new parties, get offline, go down your street, canvass your neighbours, canvass your town, get actual real data on your prospects for this campaign, because you will need it. But let's say it works. Let's say the wildest dreams of this idea actually pull through. 2021, the SNP on current polling are looking at about 50% of the constituency votes. Maybe they win 80% of the seats because of the biases in the first-past-the-post system. A new pro-ND regional party comes in and takes all of the SNP regional seats, so they win about 50% of the regional vote as well, and end up probably with about 50% of the regional seats based on that. You end up with a Scottish Parliament that has a near supermajority of seats in pro-independence hands. But you got it with less than 50% of the overall vote. If you're Boris Johnson looking at that and thinking they're going to ask for independence, what's your answer going to be? It's going to be no. You don't have a majority. The people didn't vote for you. You cheated. This has already been floated in the Unionist press. But flip the narrative here. Would you be happy if this tool was used against you? Let's say the Conservatives stood only in the constituency vote and had a pact with Labour to only stand in the regional vote, and they got a pro-union supermajority based on less than 50% of the vote. I think a few of us would be protesting outside Holyrood. Whenever you're looking for a trick in democracy, whenever you set a political precedent, it's no longer yours. You give it to your opponents to use against you. If you're not happy with it being used against you, the people you're using it against will not be happy either. And even then, even if we manage to get a pro-independence majority simply through getting a pro-independence majority of voters, say, you know, the polls hit 60%, 70%, 80%. Where do we go from there? What does that actually mean for the pressure to deliver independence? Again, think about it from Boris Johnson's point of view. In 1997, the SNP promised negotiations on independence if they won a majority in the Commons. They didn't get it then, but since 2015, we've had three general elections that have delivered a an SNP majority from Scottish votes in the Commons, and they have not delivered independence on the back of that. Primarily because right now, I mean, there's precedents of the previous referendum been set, but right now, Boris Johnson wins votes among his peers by talking tough to the Scotch. That's why he's up in Scotland right now. Talking tough to the Scotch loses him almost no votes, because there's not very many votes in Scotland for him to lose. So denying another referendum doesn't just not cost him anything, it probably bolsters his position. The same will be true in the Holyrood elections. Until and unless that position reverses, until and unless it costs Boris Johnson more to say no to independence than it costs him to say yes to independence, then it actually doesn't really matter what trick we use to deliver our mandate. Now, Commonweal produced a paper on this back in January called Within Our Grasp. It's downloadable on our website, and it basically outlines a maximum pressure campaign of escalating through confrontation, through humiliation, mocking the UK institutions, up to civil obedience. So the SNP MPs in the Commons following all those arcane rules and in ways that maximally disrupt the proceedings of the House of Commons. One I'd really like to see done is what was once known as the I Spy Strangers rule, where any MP can stand up and say that there are non-politicians in the public chamber and they should be ejected. And the Parliament has to take a vote on it. And if the vote is successful, the cameras get turned off and all the non-politicians get escorted out of the building. Now, the vote won't pass, but it takes up to an hour to cast a vote at the moment. Imagine calling I Spy Strangers just at the start of PMQs every single week. So using some of these rules to disrupt the House of Commons until you get to the point that Boris Johnson says, ah, away we is, I'm sick he is. That's the point where we start talking about getting another referendum. I encourage people to read the paper. There's more tricks like that in there. I could give an entire talk on just that paper alone. Well, we've got to get a plug in for a repeat visit. So our conclusion. I would say that gaming the Scottish political system is hard. It is designed to produce a parliament that is proportional to the number of votes that you get on the regional list. It resists being gamed in other ways. The best way of getting a pro-independence majority, in my opinion, is to get a majority of pro-independence voters out there casting ballots. The AMS system will sort the parliament accordingly. Now, what you then get into is a discussion over what shape of that parliament do you want? Do you want one party to have absolute control over the pro-independence debate in the parliament, or do you want a collegiate coalition of two or more parties cooperating with each other? And we'll all have our own opinions on which is the best way to go with that. According to recent polls, the SNP are probably looking at a majority anyway. I mean, we're still several months out. It's still a long way. A week is a long time in politics, especially when your country's in near meltdown. So, does the independence vote even need gamed? It's something to consider. And we have to consider that if these new parties are coming along, and they are coming along with policies that a good number of voters find objectionable, then that's a discussion to be had as well. But that's not really a major part of this. That's just politics. You know, if you don't like my party, don't vote for me. But if I don't like your party, don't get upset if I don't vote for yours. Don't take voters for granted, especially when you're trying to play strategic games. And I'll leave you with one thought. Probably the most successful party in recent UK political history never won a single seat in its time in the Commons. it managed to briefly have two MPs, both of them defected from another party. And yet that party, UKIP, managed to achieve its primary goal of pulling the UK out of the EU. Perhaps there are lessons for pressure campaigns in what they've done. At this point, I'd usually go into plug mode for Commonweal. I'd usually try and direct people to our shop because we've done a lot of work on independence. All of our policy papers are in our policy library. Please go and download them. In our shop, we have books like How to Start a New Country, our blueprint for what happens the day after a yes vote in a referendum up to Independence Day. We have an atlas called The Atlas of Opportunity, which really is a beautiful book that shows you really what Scotland could be as a nation. Unfortunately, due to the pandemic, our shop is currently closed, so I can't ask you to buy anything from it. We are hoping to get it reopened very soon now that the pandemic restrictions are easing. We are looking at ways of reopening the shop. The last thing to say is Commonweal as an organisation, while I've not been talking on their behalf directly tonight, we are completely funded by folk like yourselves, donating a fiver or a tenner a month. So if you do go onto the website, you do like what we're doing and you do like what we're campaigning for, please help us, please donate to us and keep us going. So thank you. I'll pass back over to Ruth and then we'll get some questions.
Well, consider yourself cyber applauded, Craig. That was really interesting. Thank you very much for taking the time and the thought to explain it so clearly. I'm seeing people are looking to ask questions. Yes, Morgan Davis, you do need to type it out because I'm not telepathic, so thank you for that. While people are having a think about the kind of questions they want to ask, we do have a couple of representatives from a couple of different sides of the conversation, politically speaking. So I'll go straight to Pat Lee, who is one of the people behind Max the Yes, and I believe is also sort of working towards the Alliance for Independence. So Pat Lee, are you there? And would you like to have just a wee bit of a take a couple of minutes to explain your perspective and you know, your viewpoints, bearing in mind the presentation Craig's just given us?
Yes, thank you very much, Ruth. As you've explained, I'm Pat Lee, and the Alliance for Independence, hashtag Max the Yes, are one and the same. So I'll just clear that up. It's not two parties. They're one and the same. Now, I take umbrage with Craig, where the constant is we are gaming the system. We're not gaming the system. We are using the system that is there to stand for election. That is the purpose of the Alliance for Independence. But it's we're trying to create a platform where we can unite the Yes movement vote. And I don't call it the SNP deliberately, the SNP vote. It's the Yes vote. Because not everybody that's a yeser is an SNP member. So we have smaller parties that don't get the representation, as you've stated, Craig. And we wish to form that platform where everyone, including the Greens, come and unite. Because the question is, do we want independence? It is determined on the participation of the whole of the Yes movement. Because Craig stated everything tonight. The polls are suggesting that there is a 5% increase. Correct me if I'm wrong, Craig. There's a 5% increase in support for the SNP at constituency level, and it is possible they will pick up 70 to 73 seats. Some are saying 74, but I'd like you to clarify this, Craig. If they pick up all the constituency seats, will they have any room to pick up list seats? And if not, it will be more minimal than the four they have at this present time. So if they're not picking up any pro-independence seats, where is that vote, that pro-independence vote, going to count effectively? And I know you say vote the Greens. If you're saying that our concept is to game the system, is that not just the same? it's gaming the system, in your words. I don't believe it's gaming the system. I believe it's standing for election.
Because what do you have to say? What do you have to say to that, Craig?
Don't assume that I was talking about any individual new party when I made that statement. to say that, I think part of the perspective flip we need to do is to stop thinking about the constituency seat as that first vote, which some people still do, when the purpose of the AMS system is to produce a parliament that is roughly proportional to the regional vote, taking into account what has happened on the constituency vote. But it does, you are right, it does assume that people don't generally split their vote. So the purpose of the AMS system is if 40% of people vote for the SNP in the regional vote, and in the constituency vote, they should end up with 40% of the seats in Parliament. Now, if things go into uncharted territory, where you get massive swings on the constituency that's not replicated on the regional, and you get massive new parties rising in the regional, then that assumption does break. And it's not really me saying they're gaming the system. This is, as I say, this has already come out of the unionist press.
That's the narrative.
So, and that is the narrative that is being framed and will be used unless there is some sort of push against it or some sort of pressure in the form of, you know, what we've been seeing and within our grasp.
So
it does, you know, it can't really be denied that if the polls are saying that 50% of Scots are pro-independence, yet somehow we've ended up with a parliament that is 80% pro-independence, then maybe something has gone slightly unusual with the election.
So can I then ask, Pat, what is the way that these new parties are being framed? Is that they are targeting list seats rather than competing with constituency votes? What do you think? I mean, is your view that these seats or seats being contested by your party and colleagues within the alliance, that is going to be somehow the equivalent of, for example, a Labour voter voting for the Conservatives in their second vote, if that was what they chose to do? Is that the way that you're looking at it?
No, I'm looking at our focus is independence. We have a system that we have to work under, and that is the AMS hybrid de Hoyne. Our aims and objectives are on our page at the Alliance for Independence, hashtag Max the Yes. But the purpose is a ground floor grassroots alliance to maximise the number of pro-independence MSPs elected to the Scottish Parliament using the only system that's available. The concept is whether we have our independence referendum this year or not, we need to ensure that a supermajority of pro-independence MSPs are there to represent the Yes movement, not just a political party. Because when we politicise our debate on independence, we give the unionist the stick to beat us with. To gain our independence, we have to be more radical. And it's a radical action whereby we mobilise the Yes movement as a whole, as we did in 2015, to deliver 56 out of 59 and gain more than 50% of the electorate. That states there's 50% plus support for independence. And no country leaving the empire has ever asked permission, to my knowledge.
So thank you very much for that, Pat. So taking that point, Craig, is it then, do you think, a question of a party which appears to just have, you know, sort of one primary sort of electioneering message for the electorate to listen to? In what way, in and it's very hard to say, how long is a piece of string, in what way do you think that could be either a positive thing or something which could be working within the system. What is your assessment of how effective that will be as a fair and representative way of getting seats which represent the wishes of the majority of people in Scotland?
I mean, it's not even to say that single issue or special interest parties have had no presence in Scotland. I mean, they actually have in previous years as well. So there is a place for that kind of politics. My main barrier is actually, you know, the step of what next. You know, if a majority of pro-independence voices are elected to the Scottish Parliament, whether it's a majority of one or majority of 30, 40, whatever, I think that there still will not be enough pressure on Westminster to do much with that. I think Boris will still have the incentive to say no. He will have sticks to beat the campaign with, you know, no matter what happens, he has plenty of sticks. It's what we do when he swings them that counts. So that's why I'm kind of looking more at the pressure campaign that rather than necessarily what happens in the next election.
So I was at a couple of Women for Independence meetings over a year or so, and in the first one, Joanna Cherry was there, and she was talking specifically about this question of what happens if Section 30, that is the gold standard, but if nobody says we can go for it, then what do we do? And she spoke about the need for there being an electoral event, which was could be accepted by the international community. And several months later, I was at another Women for Independence meeting, and First Minister Nicola Sturgeon was there, and she used almost exactly the same words. And because, you know, she was saying, well, if I could dissolve the union tomorrow, I would, and we'd have a brilliant party, but then the rest of the world wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't pay any heed to it. So we need to show that we've exhausted Section 30, and then we've come to come to an electoral event. So I'm very interested to see Joanna Cherry today in the paper saying, you know, let's have a look and see what the next steps are. So anyway, with that in mind, can we please move on to Morgan, because my psychic spidey senses tell me that he has a question that he would like to ask. Morgan, are you there, please?
Yes. one of the reasons for the new parties is this belief that if they take votes from the SNP on the list, they will increase the number of pro-independent MSPs. But there is another way to do that, and that's to maximise the SNP list vote. The reason they didn't win a majority in 2016, unlike 2011, is that the list vote was lower than the constituency vote. People took advice not to vote one to SNP and voted for other parties. So I suppose my question would be, should all these new parties and the Scottish Greens step down so that the only choice on the list to vote for a pro-independence party is the SNP, and maximise number of SNP MSPs? It would maximise in one place the level of support for independence and achieve what some of these new parties say they wish to achieve.
Now, that's wow, Morgan, that's Fechtin talk, I think, Morgan.
a very radical view. I recognise that.
Always love a devil's advocate.
there are problems with it.
Well, remember what I said about the disproportional nature of the voting system. The SNP are already overrepresented in Parliament compared to their Parliament, the vote in 2016. So pushing that even further, you do hit the same sort of barriers of over representation that you'd get by gaming the system in another way, with the possible additional stick of reconcentrating the debate on party politics. It's a lot easier for Boris Johnson to beat the SNP than it is for him to beat an entire movement. Sticking that green hat back on again, a lot of people are not happy with the green credentials of the SNP and therefore would like to see more green representation in politics. A lot of people would like to see, maybe are unhappy with other aspects of SNP policy and would like to see those aspects represented. So a more collegiate rainbow parliament might lead to healthier politics in Scotland as well. So yeah,
I think you also have to bear in mind that knocking on as many doors as I have in the last few years, where I am anyway, here in Angus, there's very much the case that there are people who would rather saw their arm off and beat themselves to death with it than vote SNP, but they perhaps have come from the Tories or they've come from Labour, and they don't feel that they have a home there, but they can look at the climate emergency and consider green. I've certainly come across people who have said that. I think Ian White has got some comments that he might want to be giving us a flavour of from the chat here. Ian, what are you seeing? Well,
can I just very quickly chip in on the comment you made there about Conservative and Labour voters? One interesting thing about the polls recently is that pro-independence sentiment is rising among voters of other, you know, traditionally pro-union parties. And one interesting fact is that there are almost certainly more pro-independence Labour voters in Scotland than there are Labour members. So conceivably, pro-independence Labour voters could join the party, force through a pro-independence motion through their branches, and win a vote at conference to turn Labour into a pro-independence party. The same is also true for the Lib Dems. The same is also true for the Conservatives. There are more pro-independence Conservative voters in Scotland now than there are current members of the Scottish Conservative Party. That's how fragile the union is right now. So if you're out canvassing, find these people, get them signed up to the movement. That is one thing that will bring more pressure than probably any election.
That's one of the things we need to bear in mind when we're out talking to people, and be sure that we are very inclusive of those people who perhaps are not to the left wing of the Yes movement. But I am aware of certain branches to the north and to the south of where I am that actually have Conservative Party members in their Yes groups. So so I think it is very behoven upon us to be polite and welcoming. Sorry, Ian, you have a number of comments to be mulling over.
Well, I'm just going through the chat. One thing quickly, Craig, could you maybe take your screen off now and we'll get to see all the faces, or is that just on mine? There are one or two, three or four different ideas about what the SNP should do. So on that score particularly, I've unmuted Mr. Duff. So Ruth, if you want to take that.
So Bill, what are your views on what you're hearing? I'm seeing some people in the chat saying that the SNP, it's time for the SNP to stand aside and give some of these new parties a chance. What are your views as an SNP councillor and politician? What are your views?
I jotted three things down before the talk started. I thought it was an excellent talk from Craig. A lot of, I would say, very good sense. The first thing I wrote down is how difficult it is to start a new party. I'm old enough to remember Jim Sellers in the 1970s, and he was a pretty capable campaigner then, trying to start the Scottish Labour Party, if anyone remembers that. That failed. So starting a new party is difficult. Anna Soubry and her mates tried it last year, and that bombed. The second thing I think is, and I would disagree with Pat Lee. I think people are trying to game the system, and I don't think that's philosophically, morally, I don't think that's right. As Craig explained, there was a huge amount of work went into setting up the Scottish Parliament to have a PR, a proportional parliament. And if, let's say, 55% of the population are in favour of independence, I don't think we help the case by gaming the parliament and having, let's say, 70% of the seats held by independent supporters. What is the advantage of that? As Churchill said, one is a majority. If you've got a majority, you've got a majority. The question is, getting that Section 30 order or whatever other method we're using. So that's the second point I would make. The third point, which I think is the most important one, is people are taking the result next year for granted. They're assuming that the SNP are going to win. And, you know, the polls are saying whatever it was, 70 seats plus we'll have 6 or 7 or 8 Greens. So that's a comfortable majority for pro-independence parties. What if we have, what if the SNP vote drops back? And I'll remind you about the 2007 election result where the SNP got one more seat than Labour. And the D'Hondt system worked very well because they got slightly more votes than Labour and that got them that extra seat. The list mechanism, as Craig's explained very clearly, is about balancing it. So if we lost a lot of marginal seats, if you take Angus North and Mearns, where the SNP majority is about 2,500, if we lost that seat and we didn't win Aberdeen West, which is Conservative, then potentially we would pick up seats on the northeast list. And that would partly compensate for losing the first past the post seats. So remember, you know, like investments can go up and down, your political fortunes can go up and down, and the list is there as a balancing mechanism. So that would be why I would be very reluctant to entertain any of these ideas. And I think starting a new party from where we are now, yeah, people know about it in Twitter, but as I think Craig said, the Twitter population in Scotland is tiny. You're going to have to sell that on the streets. And who are your party? What are your policies? Are the people knowing? Lots of problems.
So that does take us back then to basically what do we want out of an election? Well, for me, obviously, I would like to see an independent Scotland, but I guess the most important thing is that we have a country that is, that the population within that country feels that they have been fairly and democratically represented. What are your thoughts, Craig? You know, listening to some of the points coming across, is there anything sort of jumping out at you that a lot of people have said to me when they've been trying to persuade me that an indie list party is a good idea, that, oh, well, we're never going to get it if we just vote SNP 1 and 2, because the system means that we will never get, that the SNP can't maximise that. But if in some parts of the country we vote for the list vote in other ways, and somehow we can sort of, you know, get those votes across. I don't know enough about statistics to know if for example voting SNP for a constituency SNP and then voting for a green list, if that would make a massive difference. I mean, otherwise, other than to you, obviously, as a green, you want to see lots of people voting green. But if I am wanting to make sure that my vote gets me a majority of independents, MSPs, who I have to say are that one of my biggest concerns about a list, a new party, is that it doesn't have a track record and it perhaps doesn't have a calibre of representation that I would be looking for from a more established party, which I think is one of the reasons why many people would trust an SNP 1 and 2, and it's a simple message, or people, for example, looking at the Greens thinking you're an international and well-established party with a track record. So what are your views with your neutral hat on? And then you can talk about it from a green perspective, but from an academic point of view, what are your views, please?
I mean, when you start talking about even more sophisticated electoral strategies, like pushing a vote in one area and not in another area to try and tweak out those marginal majorities and maximize them there, minimize them here. You have to remember that it's not an exercise in statistics, it's an exercise in people. You're talking about voters here. You can't, by definition, you can't control how someone votes, otherwise you don't have a democracy. So the more complex you make the scheme, I think the more likelihood it has of failing. What you need is a compelling narrative of why should people vote for you, and they will, if you make that narrative compelling enough, and AMS, with its, you know, flawed as it is, will generally try to sort it out for you. Trying to push against the system will get you into trouble. Just, you know, trusting the system to a degree, trusting voters to a degree, that will get you there. You
know, I presume that means that we have to have a clear message, and people have to trust what they're looking at, either the individual because they know them and they're well known, or in terms of the party and that party's well known. And I understand that there are many individuals who perhaps could stand as a lone candidate as an independent, and they might get votes because everybody knows them. But what do you think then? Is in your point, from your point of view, if somebody was to come and tap on your door and offer you up various options, what would your thought processes be if you were just a general punter and didn't have your head full of knowledge like you do?
I mean, one of the things I'd actually be considering is this an independence plebiscite? And the answer right now, probably it isn't. Probably the Scottish election will not result in Scotland declaring making a unilateral declaration of independence and walking away from the union based on the election results. So even if it does produce enough pressure to result in independence, then we still need to consider all the other things that the MSPs are doing. So I would be looking not just at their independence credentials, I'd be looking at their other policies as well. And I would be looking for a candidate who represents my views as closely as possible.
That sounds very interesting. I'm sure lots of food for thought. It's not just a candidate, the party they represent, it's the quality of the candidate before you.
I have to say that I have approached elections. I'll just say it because it is public knowledge. You know, I have approached UK general elections where I have been extremely tempted to vote for Labour, especially Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto, but in the end decided not to because the calibre of the local candidate here didn't meet my expectations.
Well, I have to tell you, as a full disclosure, the first time I voted Green was when I was working in Glasgow about 30 years ago, and that was when George Galloway was up as a Labour candidate, and I decided I would throw my vote to the Greens to help you keep your deposit, because I couldn't bear the thought of voting for George Galloway. Now,
Galloway is apparently standing on the regional list in the south of Scotland, which is my patch, so I wonder what narrative he'll try to give me.
Yes, that'll be interesting. So we have a local, one of our Yes Kerry members is coming up next. Jeff has a boffin's mind and can look at figures and make sense of them in a way that I cannot, and we've had some really interesting meetings with Jeff, doing some really interesting number crunching. So Jeff, are you there, and have you got a point you would like to make?
Hi, yes, I am here. I think one of the points I'd like to make is that some people vote for SNP not because they want independence, but because they think SNP policies were quite good. And that was the boat I was in. I moved here in 2007. SNP were offering the best policy, and I felt, as an Englishman, that I could always vote no in a referendum. As it turned out, at the end, I was persuaded that the no campaign were basically untrustworthy, and I didn't like what was going on in Westminster, so I voted yes, but only in the last few weeks before the campaign, and I've been fairly active since then. But if you look at the figures and the representation of the SNP in terms of the list vote in each of the elections since 97, they have never been underrepresented by the proportion of seats they've got compared to the proportion of list vote they've got. And I think actually in 2007, you would not have got an SNP government had it not been the way people voted on the list seat. So I don't think we really want to mess about with the system. I'm quite happy with the system the way it works. If you want to vote for a yes party that has not the SNP, because they have other policies that you wish to support, then that's fine. That seems perfectly reasonable. Is that enough, Ruth?
Yeah. No, thank you very much for your observation. Out of interest, I know that you live in a quite a small community, and it's a small rural community, and you do quite a lot of sort of conversing with local people. What level of recognition do you think there is within within some of the rural communities? In fact, this is a question I will throw up to Bill Duff and to Pat Lee as well, if they've got any market research about this. What level of recognition is there for, and of course you too, Craig, what level of recognition is there for among voters at the door? When you talk to people about your party, what level of recognition is there? So Jeff, just starting with you, because there's about 100 people live in your community. Do people even know who the Labour leader is or who the Green leader is? Do people know or do they care when you sort of go knocking on their door to ask if they're going to vote? Do people even turn out to vote? Because I know that you've got the keys to the electoral station. So starting with Jeff, and then I shall go to Pat, and then I shall go to Bill, and then I shall go to Craig.
Immediate vicinity around here, there's quite a lot of elderly people, but I think the support for yes is quite high. In answer to your other questions, I'm really not entirely sure what the level of recognition of, say, the Labour leader is.
Right. So do you think that people are switched on enough to start looking out with the trammelled lines that they generally go when they go to the electoral box, you know, and look at the choices before them? Do you get just in general feeling, do you think that they are engaged enough that they are going to be going, ooh, this is interesting, let's have a look at other options?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, we're talking about quite a number of elderly people around here, and I think they have their views and they stick to them.
Thank you very much. Pat Lee, do you have any market research which shows what work you guys would need to do to get a level of recognition which would mean people might have, there would be voter confidence out with of the micro yes bubble?
We don't have any market research because we're a brand new party starting up. But what we have done is when we formed back in February, we started touring the country, talking directly. We weren't a party at that time. It was an idea that we wish to take to the Yes movement. And we have had, around the country, we have had very positive feedback from those meetings. Unfortunately, COVID kicked in, or we would be participating in views, and we were getting invites from around the country, from SNP groups as well, to discuss and debate openly and honestly the concept of Max the Yes. So we don't have any actual physical information that we can give you other than the meetings that we've attended around the country and the positive feedback from that.
So that is positive from within the Yes bubble and people who are interested. So an example of some of what we may be up against is I've been out just before an election in 2017, and I was talking to an SNP member who is, I think, pretty switched on, she's not as switched on, you know, she's not as engaged as I am. And I was talking about I must have been doing the Joanna Cherry Cherry court case, and she looked at me and said, "Who's Joanna Cherry?" Now, this is somebody who's interested in politics and is interested in independence, is passionate, she's been pro-Indy for about 20, 30 years longer than I have. And she still doesn't know who was what, but she does know that when she goes to the ballot box, she's going to tick SNP because they're going to get her independence. So, I think that's, you know, is that not one of the biggest issues that you're going to be up against, is that once you step outside the Yes bubble, there's very little voter recognition.
Yes, but we're calling on the whole of the Yes movement to get involved here. So you're talking about 1.6 to 2.2 million people. If we can get a percentage of that, all working to promote the SNP at this constituency list, then we give them a platform for their regional list vote. And yes, we've still to have our conference. We are also going to have to start the campaign. And that's where we get out on the doorsteps. But it will need a coordinated effort from the whole of the Yes movement. It won't work without it.
So I'm going to come to build off in a second, but Craig, that surely is kind of the nub of what we're up against, what Pat and his colleagues are up against, is that nobody knows who they are unless you happen to inhabit a certain corner of Twitter.
There's an additional problem that I never really mentioned in the talk, that there is a bias against the regional list from the perspective of the media and from the perspective of people who organise hustings. I do remember in the 2016 election where, again, just not quite with the green hat on, but mentioning them, there were a lot of places in Scotland where Greens couldn't get onto the platform of a husting because they were only standing in the region. They didn't have a constituency candidate, to the point where some Green branches were putting up Green paper candidates because the £500 deposit was worth the price of the ticket of getting on the stage. And that is... that's a criticism of the media and the approach to campaigning rather than a criticism of the election system itself. And it's one that needs to be overcome. As far as the question on sort of local awareness around here, I stood in the 2017 council elections again as a Green, and I went in with the objective of not coming last, and I am quite happy to say that I managed to beat UKIP and the Lib Dems.
Yay! So
walked away, I mean, you know, didn't win, didn't come close to winning, but, you know, I managed to stand proudly on the stage with that.
Can I come in there? Because time, I'm getting a few to say, can we move things, because there have been a number of questions. Quite a few questions up and down the screen. I know, Ruth, you wanted to go back. Did you have a question for Bill in response? But there's quite a few questions up the screen that I'd like to bring people in.
Well, go for it, Ian.
You said you were going to bring Bill in here. If you can have a response.
Okay. So Bill, where are you on this? I know that you spend a lot of time doing a lot of work with you know, around Angus and Aberdeenshire, looking at sort of public opinion and polls and stats, and you're very aware of a lot of the market research. What is your take on where we're at electorally speaking, and what do you think it's going to take? Firstly, two questions for you. What is it going to take for Scotland to get a pro-Indy majority in Holyrood? And what is it going to take for us to get independence? What's the next step? What are those two crucial steps?
Well, I mean, going back to the 14 referendum, I think the yes vote in Angus was 45%, which was bang on the Scottish vote. So in that sense, we were very much a microcosm of Scotland. I guess I've always taken, it's anecdotal, I know, but I think probably only 90% of SNP supporters in Angus actually want independence. There's at least 10% who actually don't want independence. You'll find that on the doors when you speak to them. It was probably higher than that. It was probably 20% at one point, but then 10% have been hived off because they were in favour of Brexit, and we've lost them. They will now vote Conservative or whatever, or not vote. So it's probably a better percentage now support independence. I suspect, I've been interested in politics all my life. I am completely, my head's now sore with all these additional parties, and I don't really know who's involved in them, what they stand for. It seems to be an alphabet soup of initials. If I'm struggling to get my head around that, I really don't think the average member of the public who's not, we're all political anoraks, that's why we're on this call at 8:30 at night. The average member of the public has just got, that's the problem with any new party, is getting that credibility. I think getting onto TV shows, getting into the Record or the Sun, I think that's the problem. Irrespective of the clever things you think you can do on the list. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what we need to do is we need to get 55% supporting independence up to 60. If we can get that, we're not quite home and dry, but we're at least on the right track. If you believe the polls now, we're above 50. And if you want to vote for a second party on the list, you don't want to vote SNP, you've got a tried and tested, genuine party there in the Greens. Why mess around with another party? That would be my thinking as a punter rather than as an SNP member. You know, how many additional pro-independence parties do you need? I don't agree with lots of Green policies. There are some SNP policies I don't particularly like. But you're at least voting for a genuine political party that's got some sort of track record.
Okay.
I have to say, sort of that personally speaking, I think that I would like to see Holyrood in an independent country looking fairly similar to some of the, you know, sort of the German or French sort of parliaments, where there are a multiple of small parties and people have to form genuine coalitions and really speak to each other. However, I do want to see that they are parties which have got sincere and credible policies which have been genuinely and thoroughly thought out. And I am not convinced that I'm seeing that at this point yet. But I think it's really important that we have this moving forward in the future, that there perhaps is. I think we need to have more diversity of view. However, that's my own personal viewpoint. Ian,
can I go to a question from Brian Miller, please? We've got to rattle through quite a few questions here, and I think we should just go through the screen.
Okay, you've got the floor.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, hi. Sorry, you're not getting a picture because I've got processor problems with my laptop. My question is, and it's coming back to you, Craig, I like the idea of the pressure campaign, but my problem is, I spy a stranger. Would the Conservatives, A, not just pass any new legislation that actually removed that as a point of pressure, and B, we've got a good representation of the House of Commons just now, but they don't seem to want to use a point of order as an interruptive device that Anna Soubry successfully used just about through her whole political campaign. So how can we get the SNP MPs motivated to actually do this pressure campaign?
Right, well, on motivating the MPs, write to them and ask them, and just make it clear that if they don't represent you, then maybe someone else will at the next election. On the tricks, on the techniques and the strategies they can use there, that is just one of them. Think about the implications of what you just said there. In order to stop the nationalists, we had to dismantle our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's a powerful bit of pressure there. If you start finding all of those things, and they have to start crossing out all those lines, and we just find another one, and another one, and another one. Okay. Mary Black had a great lecture a couple of years ago at Strathclyde Uni. It's on YouTube, where she talked in fairly disparaging terms about some of the tricks that the Conservative MPs use to disrupt Parliament. Things like calling points of order, things like hiding in the toilets in the voting lobby until the Sergeant at Arms marches them back into the chamber at sword point. Another one is, in order to have a legally constituted quorum in the Commons, you have to have at least 40 MPs in the chamber. So Tory MPs have disrupted debates by asking for a quorum motion when the chamber has been packed, to force a vote on the issue, to check to see if the 300 odd people in there was more than 40.
Craig, can I say, Craig, that as you said, you could do a whole discussion on this topic. Can you send me the links to that, and I will add it and send it out to everyone?
Will do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Can I go to Jean Moffat?
One of my questions was, why can we not stand somebody that's not for a party, but like an independent, as Margot MacDonald was at the end. So there are various high profile people like Leslie Radoch and, you know, that are well known, who could stand on an independence platform and whatever their policies are, but without being actually associated with any party.
It could be done, and there have been independents elected in both the parliaments. The problem is resources. It's expensive to run for elections and to run campaigns, so you need the backing of multiple people behind you to do it. It's more effective, more efficient to do it if one organisation is coordinating multiple candidates. It's easier to do that if those candidates are singing from a similar or the same policy platform, because that makes printing leaflets easier, it makes media attention easier, and I've just invented a political party.
Yeah, well, it's the Yes Alliance party, so, isn't it?
But now you're not independents. You're a political party. So I'm not saying no. Of 129 MSPs in the Scottish Parliament, I would love it if there was 129 parties in the Parliament, but you will eventually then get coalitions, and coalitions then merge and have voting alliances, and then they have someone coordinating them, so you get a whip, and you've just invented a political party again.
But we're not
going to
have 129 parties. That's no taking it seriously.
My point is, political parties are an inevitability of politics. You can fight against them, and I would love to see more independent voices in the Parliament, and they should be encouraged wherever possible, but parties will always come back.
I think is the point, Jean, not that it is always possible for one person to stand. People do that. But if you are saying, well, lots of independent individuals should stand sort of like a super council election, but then enter, sort of throw their hat under the umbrella of the Alliance for Independence. I'm not understanding then, because you started saying one thing and then you said they could go with the Alliance for Independence. What can you just clarify for me, please, what it is? Because people are loving your idea, but just so that we can understand what it is that you're proposing.
I think there are a number of regional seats where the SNP, for example, or indeed the Greens, don't stand a chance of winning, or at least like even any seats, and that they will go to unionist parties. So I think in selected seats, if there were a sufficient number of very high profile candidates that people would recognise, that would stand in selected seats, that they wanted to stand in that seat, they could run as independents. Now, as each of them would be an independent supporter, then they would come under a Yes banner, but that doesn't mean to say it has to be a Yes party, all formed and constituted, because at the moment we have a whole Yes party, a Yes movement that's running all over Scotland. So I mean, I don't think Craig's comment about having 129 independents.
I was being hyperbolic.
I know, but call
it an ideal.
It's kind of like there's quite a lot of facetiousness that comes in about this discussion about not doing SNP 1 and 2 and having a different party, such as the Alliance or the Yes Movement or whatever it is. And I think it's quite off-putting for some people to, when they feel they're getting talked down to and they're trying really hard to understand the mechanics of it.
I think that when you're talking about, when I look back at politics, so, you know, living in Orkney and Shetland, when I look back at politics that used to happen in those elections, local candidates could stand, for example, in councils and town councils, and they were well known. And often in rural communities, you do get a lot of independent councillors who stand on their own, just on their own personalities, because yeah, the local community knows them. And not to put words into Craig's mouth, but I suspect that that's probably kind of what he was talking about, is that there are many people, myself included, who would like to see party politics ripped out of the belly of the beast and actually sort of people coming up and sort of having the integrity to be the representatives, which is why we've got the old system of with MPs. So I guess the problem comes when you're talking about there being 8 or 10 months to go before the elections next year. That's a very short time to establish sort of individuals in the way that, that you suggest, but maybe that's something to look at in the longer term. So moving forward, what do you think, Craig, given that the election is coming up in May next year, given that we are looking at, I really just hope that the SNP and the Greens have got this arc that they've been building and they're just going to kick the walls down and we'll sail off. You know, that's my big dream. But in the world of realities, do you think that there is a point at which we've got two options? One of my big concerns and concerns I see across Scottish Twitter and social media is that the minute after Brexit happens and the minute after we're out of the European Court of Human Rights, the jackboots will descend upon Holyrood and it will be closed or disemboweled, and we will lose meaningful democracy and devolution in Scotland. And I'm not sure what there is to stop a fairly aggressive Westminster from doing that. And the other thing is, what options are there? I live in hope, perhaps, of there being like a sort of a Yugoslavia moment where the whole thing just comes falling down around everybody's ears and Scotland sort of escapes sort of by default. But looking at the realities ahead of us, what do you think, Craig, is the best way that we in Scotland can achieve independence? How do we pressure our politicians to get us across the line before Holyrood's close down as many of us fear, and you know, just to try and get out in a socially distanced world to get the message across that we need to get an independent country? How do we do all this before May?
You need to get me back to talk about that paper within our grasp in detail. There's enough in that about building that pressure campaign and the details there. So I'd point people towards that. I don't think that Holyrood will be actively shut down, because that again is a step that would cause even Boris Johnson a significant amount of pain over. But disemboweled? Well, that's already happening, isn't it? We've seen that with the trade bills. So I can see more of that happening. I can certainly already see him making investment decisions in Scotland based on the politics rather than the economics of it, rather than the benefit to people in Scotland, but more to the benefit of his voters. So we need to, you know, be guarding against that as well.
So just we're coming towards the end of our session here. So just finally Oh, hang on, somebody's saying, the words of Wee Ginger Doug regarding the closure of Holyrood, the Tories may be stupid, but they're not that stupid. Thank you very much, Raymond, for that. So just to as a final word on your final plug, Pat Lee, if the magic fingers of Ian can untap you, do you have a final punt for your position?
Yes, sir. I'm pretty techno non-savvy, so apologies here. The Alliance for Independence is simply an opportunity to build a platform where we can elect pro-independence MSPs, and there are plenty of talent within the Alliance, and remove the maximum number of unionists, seat warmers, as we call them, I call them. We have lodged our papers with the Electoral Commission today, and we are moving forward. We will go forward and we will stand.
Thank you very much. Coming to Ian White for his big green question.
I noted that there hadn't been a direct interjection in Craig's, but I thought done very well keeping between the hats. And my question was to Craig as to what impact the Greens have in Holyrood that they don't have elsewhere, such as in Westminster. And sort of, are the Greens going to be standing everywhere across the country?
Well, in terms of impact, I think that the last parliamentary session, this current parliamentary session, has shown what can happen in minority governments. You don't have that impetus from a majority government just to ram through its manifesto, by fiat almost. And you have seen the government be forced to, ask questions of other parties, even when they haven't sided with the Greens on a particular issue. They've been forced to confront the question of how do we get this bill passed, what changes do we need to make to do it. I'm quite a favour of minority governments now for that reason. One of my issues ultimately with politics is that the party of government doesn't need to be the best it can be, it only needs to be one vote better than the opposition. So having as strong an opposition as possible helps to push the government in ways that having a weak opposition or an impotent opposition does not. So if anything the Greens have done, even if you don't agree with their particular push and particular policies, I think they have forced the questions to be asked, the compromises to be made, and for policies to be improved.
That was magnificent, Craig, but you didn't quite answer Ian's question, which is, are the Greens going to be standing in every seat and every list? And are you going to be putting forward many constituency and candidates?
On that, they'll have a full spread of regional lists in every region. I don't know about the constituencies because, unlike a lot of parties, with the Greens, the decision to stand a candidate in a constituency is for the branches of that constituency. So it's the branches that make those decisions rather than head office. So I know that there will be constituency MSPs in the making. I don't know if they will be everywhere. And the unasked question, no, I'm not standing.
So Ian, are you happy with that? Because I did promise you I'd get you with a green question. In fact, I explicitly asked you if you would have a green question, and the evening's been going so quickly I forgot to come to you, which is very rude of me. Do you have a second question? I'll give you a second question if you have one.
No, I'm good.
So build off, what do you think, given the way the evening has gone, what are your views on the way in which you perhaps could be pressuring your party, well, our party, because I'm full disclosure, I'm an SNP member too. I joined 2 days after Brexit. But what could the SNP, should the SNP be doing to pressure its own politicians to perhaps throw the mace across Westminster and get us out of there? And what can we do locally to try and make sure that democracy is delivered and independence is delivered, if democracy demands that, in Holyrood?
Well, to be honest with you, I think Westminster's pretty irrelevant. It's a bit of a sideshow. You can make great speeches there, but it makes no difference. The Conservatives have an 80-seat majority, so yeah, it's great that we've got lots of MPs there, but they really are just, it's a grandstanding place really for them. Don't quote me on that, but that's reality.
I don't have to quote you. You're saying it yourself.
I think we do need to have a position before May next year, because people are going to say, well, what if we don't get a Section 30? What are we going to do? And I think we do need to have articulated a Plan B. I think that's we've certainly had discussions we've had it. Sort of constituency level, that's been the view of the members, and I think that's got to percolate up to the leadership. I think there's got to be a Plan B. I'm not a massive fan of Brendan McNeill and the McElhinney, but I think there needs to be a bit more articulated view. What do we do when and if Boris says no? So I think that's a thing. I think the SNP are going to have to develop a policy between now and May that I think answers that question. I think the other thing I would just caution people about is people say there's 10 months to the next election. There isn't really, because no one's campaigning at the moment. And when are we going to be able to go out and knock doors and deliver leaflets? Not at the moment. There's a sort of, you know, a hiatus at the moment. You know, if we can't get started until October, and we may not be. I mean, I think the parties already called off their October conferences. I think the SNP have. You're then into the winter, you know, December, February, pretty bad weather. You don't have a lot of time to campaign. I mean, you know, a normal campaign, you would do stuff in September, October. You then close down for the winter, start maybe late February to start for that May election. We may not have much time. You may only have a few months. So that's just a caution because of the COVID situation.
So to sum up then, Craig, when you're looking at, okay, with your green hat on, before you sum up with your academic hat on, sum up please with your green hat on. I watch Holyrood quite often, and I see that the Greens do have, you know, it's not just like sort of the David Steele and the spitting image puppet sort of pocket. The Greens definitely have their own outlook and perspective. What is the Green Party view on how they are going to try and, what's the Green plan be? If there's no Section 30, what is the Green perspective on that?
Don't think the party has an official policy on that. I know I've been, you know, again, personally, I've been writing about it. So on my personal blog, thecommongreen.scot, I have a recent blog post where I run down all the reasonable plans B, and I also give another article on a bit more details about that pressure campaign that I mentioned. For me, it's the pressure campaign is more important than the plans B, because if there isn't the pressure to give a Section 30, there isn't going to be the pressure to accept an unsanctioned referendum or a plebiscite or a national covenant or any of these other potential options. But if there is the pressure to give a Section 30 or acquiesce to an unsanctioned referendum or whatever, then it actually doesn't matter so much which plan we use. So either we have the pressure to win, in which case we'll win no matter what, or we don't have the pressure to win, in which case we'll lose no matter what.
So just to sum up with your academic hat on, in your final plug for your shameless selling your wares, your votes, you know, your plans for radical action to try and get people engaged. I mean, as a peace activist and a protester, I have absolutely no qualms with sort of lying down in front of the Polish and sort of happily waving my way through court. But what, and that gets attention. What positive actions do you think, sort of your top three positive actions before you give us a plug for your 5-step plan, and we can go and look at that?
Right. The thing I would love to see the Yes movement do right now is start canvassing your local area and find those pro-independence voters of traditionally pro-union parties. Find that pro-independence Labour.
How do we do that in a COVID world?
Phone, internet polls, Facebook, talking to your friends and family, and the ways that we're trying to do with in our physically distant world. Phone canvassing is still a potential thing that we could be doing. However we reach them, try and identify some of these people, try to bring them into the movement, because the goal for me is to see a Labour branch turn pro-Indy, then a Lib Dem one, then a Tory branch, then a vote at one of the conferences. You know, I'm thinking high here. I'm not expecting the Conservative and Unionist Party to become pro-Indy. But if they are faced with more and more pro-independence members speaking out, and they realise just how fragile things are, that's a lot of pressure to bear.
So that is Craig's unicorn for the evening. Could you please give us one final plug for your, so we know where to go and have a look at your action plan. Could you tell us where to go and have a look at
right.
that then, please?
So if you go to Commonweal's website, commonweal.scot, and go to our policy library, you will find the paper Within Our Grasp.
Brilliant. So you heard it here. Within our grasp, Dr. Craig Dyell will give us a 10-point plan for radical and suffrage action to get ourselves independence. And then we shall take that to the ballot box. I hope that this evening's presentation from Dr. Craig Dyell of Commonweal has helped answer some of your questions, has helped at least give you food for thought, actions and conversations that you can have with other informed conversations you can have with friends and colleagues. Please feel free to share this when we send you out the link. And thank you all very much. Thank you to Ian White for doing the tech and everyone for taking part and for being here. And a cyber round of applause for Dr. Craig Dyell from Commonweal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Independent Life.radio.